I just want to begin by saying I have got very little voice. I've had a terrible infection over the last few weeks. So I hope I can be heard, and I hope my voice will last. If I keel over, I think Martin's going to step in and read for me.
Or make up something.
In Ramsay's Christian Priest Today, there is no chapter entitled The Priest as Liturgist. And it may or may not be fair to suggest that Ramsay would have found the suggestion of the title of a chapter or a paper, The Priest as Liturgist, a little odd, never mind the subtitle, Inheritor, Crafter and Performer. All of these terms are a little edgy and insufficient, and a bit limiting. But they are honest, and they do explain a little of what the priest needs to be, I think, in the ensuing years, as the new liturgical diet of the Church of England begins to bed in. It may seem obvious to us that the priest needs to be first a worshipper before anything, and then a liturgist who absolves, prays, and administers the sacraments of Christ. And as Frankie Ward last night very aptly quoted from Ramsay, you will find yourself as celebrant at the Eucharist, privileged with a unique intensity to be with God, with the people on your heart. So I do hear Ramsay saying to me, why are you even addressing this subject? Because surely it is a truism that the priest needs to be a liturgist. But my response would be, well, the liturgical flux, or the degree of liturgical flux, and by that I mean creativity, experimentation, and newfound choice, as we know it today, was nowhere near as vast in the late 60s and early 70s. And so while there were liturgical reforms in the offing, the Liturgical Commission was set up in 1954, the parish priest didn't need to be a liturgist, really, in our sense of the word, because he or she just prayed, sung, and yes, performed the rites of the Book of Common Prayer, and perhaps Alternative Services Series 1. And if you were in a very forward-looking avant-garde congregation, Alternative Services Series 2. But the priest didn't have to prepare endless service booklets, sexy PowerPoint presentations, altar folders, let alone make choices of endless proper prefaces, prayers at the preparation of the table, gospel acclamations, post-communion prayers, and so on. So Ramsay might well ask me, what do you mean by liturgist then? And he would be right. It all depends on how we define the word liturgist. And by liturgist, of course, in the strict sense, we mean someone who is an authority on liturgical theology. Not someone who is self-appointed expert, but someone who is a scholar, who studies, thinks, teaches, considers, and publishes in the realms of liturgics. We think of scholars of liturgy in our current sphere, such as Paul Bradshaw, Louis Vile, John Baldovin, Keith Pecklers, David Stancliffe, Michael Vesey, Vicky Raymer, and the list would continue. But the term liturgist is in the contemporary arena being stretched way beyond what it was before, rightly or wrongly, to include those who are interested in or who are compilers of liturgical texts and rubrics. And it is this latter subtlety which makes all priests bound to at least recognise and inhabit some of the tools of the liturgist. And this is where the term liturgist for me becomes very problematic. At least that's where I am at the moment in my thinking. I'd rather leave the liturgics to the Paul Bradshaws of this world and for us to read and imbibe their wisdom, their study and their expertise, rather than us all pretending we know everything there is to know and ending up following a dead end. And I think this is what seems to be happening in the Church of England at the moment in some quarters. And I come across this in my work in Church House in Westminster as Secretary of the Liturgical Commission. The attitude of, well, I don't like what common worship is. I don't like what the church provides me. So I'm going to change it. I'm going to write my own liturgy or use it from another church altogether. This is a dangerous and un-Anglican fallacy, and it's more akin to congregationalism, and we must warn against it. And I will clarify this a little bit later, because common worship does actually allow us to adapt liturgy to our own local needs, but just within canonical limits. So what I think is a more helpful way, perhaps, of thinking about this whole area involves a subtle change to my initial title. So the title of my paper is now The Priest Within the Liturgy, Inheritor, Crafter and Performer. I want to assert in the rest of the short paper that if characteristic Anglican worship is to remain transformative, while at the same time fresh, engaging and accessible in, say, 20 years hence, the priest of the Church of England in the future needs to seriously grapple with many things, but these particular three areas which I've brought out today. One, our liturgical inheritance; two, the skills of liturgical craftsmanship; and three, the necessity of performative confidence. Our liturgical inheritance, then. It seems to be that one of the most important aspects of priesthood, which the church is rapidly losing, and to its peril, I would suggest, is the fact that we are not alone in a time-bound universe, not least in our worship. We are part of the past, the present, and the future of the ongoing liturgy, which is ceaseless in God's kingdom. We have inherited a vast tapestry of tradition from generations before us, and surely it would be nonsensical and narcissistic to put all of this into the archive box and ignore it. But the vast liturgy, which is common worship, the vast liturgical library, which is common worship, has tried to achieve this. It has tried to avoid archiving the inheritance. The reason why common worship is for some people so shockingly vast is precisely because the General Synod wanted to ensure that future worshippers of whatever churchmanship, whatever hue, and whatever tradition could all be, in the same sense, inheritors of the richness of the past. And this is, of course, most notably in Holy Scripture. The amount of scriptural glossing that's in common worship is unbelievable. If you look at a particular service in, say, Times and Seasons, and do a Google search on some of the phrases, you would be surprised at how much scripture is in there, even implicitly. Now, nobody knows that because we don't know our scriptures. And I'm not talking about lay people. By allowing space for local creativity and textual composition, common worship allows space to recognise the richness of our future as well. It allows us to bring the present and to leave it for the future. Now, common worship took a vastly different approach to anything that the Church of England had ever known before. And it's still only 12 years old, so there is much work to be done in understanding it and getting to grips with it. We need to have a bit of patience. But what it does attempt to do is to drip feed the Church of today and tomorrow the vast swathes of texts and the deep structures which the Church of the past has cherished and developed so deeply. The sometimes, and quite often, controversial Roman Catholic liturgist Lawrence Paul Hemming writes in his book Worship as a Revelation the following: "The passage of time is the means by which the liturgy of the heavenly Jerusalem unfolds into human life. The liturgy itself is primarily concerned with how the time is modulated and varies to indicate across time the whole mystery of our salvation. Taken as a whole, the texts of the liturgy, the rubrics, and the calendar all work together to make each specific liturgical action part of a much greater, more complex fabric. Basically, we must not lose our perspective. God longs for our worship, craves it, expects it. But God does not need it. Liturgy is at once the work of the people, and by that I mean the laos, living and departed, and the gift of God through Christ of himself. Elsewhere, when discussing the notion of liturgy as the work of the people, Paul Hemming rather helpfully reminds us of theologians such as Henri de Lubac, who asserted, and I quote, that the ecclesia does not assemble to do the work. The work only shows the ecclesia to have been already assembled, to belong to something mystically and invisibly wider than itself. So each office or Eucharist at which we preside or assist or even worship is merely one small window into the great cosmic liturgical event of God's kingdom. So in a sense, the local parish or chaplaincy Eucharist or morning prayer or morning praise or whatever it is at once everything and nothing. The saints and angels and holy ones of God worship him endlessly. The trouble is, we only do it for one or two, or even 3 hours a week, and if it's three, we are liturgical junkies. The words of the 4th century liturgy of St. Basil, now familiar to many of us in a hymn, reminds us of this very important notion. At his feet the six-winged seraph, cherubim with ceaseless eye, veil their faces to the presence, as with ceaseless voice they cry, Alleluia, 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 Lord Most High. Liturgy spans history, space and time. Without it, our lives are less rich and less filled with God. But the worship in the kingdom continues nonetheless. With it, as we tap into it, we become more and more infused with God's grace, which is why as priests, we should want to be worshipping all the time. I move on now to the priest as crafter. When I mentioned the enormous library of resources, which is common worship, it leads me to think of this rather recently emerging question of the priest within the liturgy as being a crafter. It's a dangerous word to use in a way, because what may come to mind is someone comparable to a goldsmith or a silversmith, or a saddler or an engraver, or any of those kind of people. Someone whose trade is precious and vital and beautiful and to be admired, but there's a sense that's fading away. The new people aren't coming forward. Now, while it might be tempting to follow this train of thought, it is, I think, unhelpful and dispiriting, and so we must avoid it. Other words are used to explain the same concept. Robin Ward takes on de Lubac's phrase of confection, confacere from the Latin, meaning to build or construct or to assemble. And this is a good phrase if we fully understand what we mean. But as somebody said to me quite recently, confection, mostly does that not mean sweetened jam making? Again, back to this beautiful but fading trade. But really, that's what we have to do with common worship. We have to construct a contextually and pastorally appropriate and missional liturgy for our parishioners and our worshipping communities, and for those who might never have been to church before. Now, the key to doing this, and to making our worship mystical and numinous, but also accessible, is threefold. Firstly, I think we need to know people. We need to understand people. I'm not meaning our people necessarily, our parishioners, that's a given, but people and culture in general. Which is why being a liturgical priest is, I think, necessarily being a pastor, first and foremost. We come back to Ramsay, who got it just right when he focused on the priest as absolver in one of his chapters, and in another when he wrote, as I've already quoted, you will find yourself as celebrant of the Eucharist, privileged with a unique intensity to be with the people on your heart. The second thing is to fully understand the deep structure of our liturgy. And to do that, we start from the basics. We mustn't get overwhelmed with the vastness of liturgical revision. We mustn't get panicked by common worship. What common worship essentially gives us is a structure around which we build our liturgical worship. We use the wide variety of resources available to us, at times composing judiciously our own texts locally, trying to give us simultaneously the notion of the Catholic, meaning that we are part of the universal wider family of worshippers, living and departed. This notion of time, history apex again. But also locally rooted and not in any way removed from the cure of souls or the community we serve. And that is quite a distinctive Anglican gem, which we must celebrate and nurture. It's not easy to get right, but it is important. And if the church is to remain missional, and if it is to touch people spiritually where nothing else in the world can possibly come close to, it must nurture this. It is about allowing people to realise that we are all tapping into this ceaseless round of heavenly worship, but at the same time that God is speaking to us all individually. Not an easy task, but neither is it impossible. And the third factor is to understand ourselves and not to be afraid to ask for help, not to be afraid of learning new things in order to teach our people what they don't know and don't understand. And I'm very struck by Alison Buxton's comments yesterday and today about people not understanding. That's true. Of course, an unchurched person is not going to easily understand the Eucharist or not think what is going on is a bit odd. But that doesn't mean that we shouldn't do it. We also need to explain it. To be missional liturgists means learning to interpret the liturgical language for our communities in a way that is neither patronising nor jarring. And there is a huge temptation to domesticate our liturgy in order for it to be accessible. But there are ways of explaining the flow of the liturgy effectively within the rite, but that comes from knowing the deep structures well. It's about knowing when to pitch in and when to let the liturgy flow. Rowan Williams, in his introduction to David Standcliffe's Festschrift, God's Transforming Work, writes, "Some supposedly contemporary styles of worship are in fact as alienating and impenetrable as any traditional forms to the uninitiated newcomer. It is not simply a question of translating material from one medium or one idiom into another. We need a deeper recognition that there are dimensions of our current human cultural situation which make the whole notion of liturgy difficult. Crucially, of course, difficult does not mean shouldn't be tried." And there is a hint here about the whole realm of liturgical language and its accessibility, which is exercising the General Synod and its Liturgical Commission quite a lot at the moment. But that is another paper and another discussion for another conference. Finally then, the priest as performer. And this is threaded into the discussion of crafting or confecting of liturgy from the basic building blocks of structure. And it's the notion of bringing the flat set of texts and rubrics to life. Because liturgy is only transformative worship when it is prayed and performed in the body of Christ, whether that be 2 or 3 people or 10,000 people, and all within the canonical framework of divine service. Now, by that, I am not in any way saying that that which is not public worship is in any way bringing less of God into a situation, because, of course, we do not bring God. We encourage people to see that God is already there. But the Church of England does nonetheless recognise the view that the church, believers gathered together, is the proper normative home of liturgical worship. In order for us to open the curtains of doubt and cynicism for the people whom we serve, then we have to have the confidence that the rites which we offer people do in fact allow something of the glimpse of heaven, which I talked about earlier. Much of this is realized in the way the liturgy is planned and performed. Now, performance again is a slightly risky word because it can suggest empty action, vain acting, or showmanship. And if any of these are present in our liturgies, then we might as well pack up, go home and watch the television, because we are offering nothing except the secular agenda of look at me and how amazing I am, or look at me, I'm in a bad mood this morning. Now, we're all in danger of becoming that caricature, but we must strive to avoid it. So by performance, I mean what ritual theorists will mean: to know and understand that the body and the space we inhabit and occupy and the way we use them are as important, perhaps more important, than the texts that we use. The biggest stumbling block to humble sacred performance, which leads us to God rather than focusing attention on me or us, is actually our lack of confidence to be Christ to our people. It is also a lack of confidence in our own abilities. The key words to a performative ceremony which taps into that ceaseless liturgy of the kingdom is prayerful humility. When I am at the altar, or when I am leading God's people in worship, I am no longer myself, but I am Christ within myself. And that means that I am neither dismissing who I am or detaching myself from my life, but I am allowing Christ to shine through me, despite all my imperfections, because that is the task I have been called to do, to be a priest who performs the sacred rites of the eternal worship of God. Udo Kassel, the German Benedictine monk, writes the following in his work, The Mystery of Christian Worship. The act of separation from the profane and the solemn initiation give a great insight into the new life. Its mysticism finds practical application, not in purely individual interior strivings, but in actions which all share. They lead to vision, not of a quietistic interior sort, but to the real showing of God. In them, all the soul's faculties are engaged. The rite is sacred art of great stylistic value, rich drama, deep symbolism, hold individual and congregation. It puts the individual into a gripping and upraising circle of divine action, carries him up beyond himself. In this kind of piety, the danger associated with lonely prayer, of sinking down to self-contemplation, the possibility of outward sacrifices becoming mere show, are easier to avoid. What Kassel, I think, is asserting then is that missional liturgy, which is transformative and which opens the window to the eternal kingdom, is performatively confident, yet humble liturgical leadership, which remains joyful and hopeful and leads us beyond ourselves, allowing people even for 5 minutes to suspend their worries and allow God to carry them into himself. My conclusion then is simply a question, and the beginning of a very brief attempt to start to answer the question. The question is, how can we possibly all achieve this? Well, the answer cannot come from me or from one person, but the church as a whole. And the answers start here and now, with us. I will be honest and say that the progress will be slow, but many of us are determined that training and development of future priests must include the understanding that leading God's people in worship is the most important and sacred action of which any of us will ever be a part. It is about knowing that we are inheritors of a long line of living and dynamic faith, and are part of an infinite body of believers, living and departed, whose primary aim and goal and purpose, whether or not they articulate it, is to worship God. Thank you.
Thank paper, but the heroic effort of delivering.
Thank you.
Well done. Hopefully, we'll just all ask you yes or no questions. Would anyone like to start us off?
I think taking a voice-up performance of space is a way in which, with our present forms, we've got even the newer ones, that there are simply too many words. Mm. I think obviously now we're in space to avoid that. We say there's nucleus for children who have got lost after all those years. I know it's not literature, sorry, but the baptism services, I mean, I think crippled by the amount of words that there are in them. Is there any way we can get away from lots of words and more into what the action is actually trying to say in itself, give it freedom to say what it wants to say?
Yes, I think, I mean, there are ways of reducing the text. It's simply about knowing how to interpret the rubrics, and that is not always easy. So, for example, where a rubric says the priest may use these or other suitable words, most people will just use the words that are printed, but other suitable words means words that the priest, him or herself, can fashion. And that may be a lot shorter than what's given, and probably should be. But I think, you know, obviously it depends on the context that you're working in. And that's, I say that because we're in the middle of redrafting or producing additional baptism texts for use in accessible language. Now, nobody can define what accessible language is. So the Synod has asked the Liturgical Commission to produce a new baptism rite in accessible language, but nobody can define accessible language, because what is accessible in Liverpool, where the Synod motion came from, may not be accessible in Cambridge, and vice versa. So what we need to do is find a way of bringing the liturgy to life from a basic set of texts through performance and through knowing how to interpret the rubrics so that we can use the texts that are available or something else that's more appropriate.
Is there a sense in which not just language being inaccessible sometimes, but the way the text wants to say everything that can be said about the subject?
Yes.
Perhaps in particular one, there's a whole through there, Exodus, all these images, all great stuff, but there's too many things in there.
Absolutely, and I think that, you know, they won't ever say it, but I think, you know, the Synod recognises that, which is why it's asked for alternatives. And, the biggest problem with Christian initiation, that volume, the baptism, was it was not road tested, it wasn't trialled. And I think there's a lot to be said for trialing of liturgical texts, because you get so much feedback and so much response from people who are using it. And I think that was the downfall of that.
Christopher, I'm wondering about the value of learning things off by heart and familiarity and how formative that can be. I'm wondering on your reflections, because I think part of the problem of too many words is that they become devalued because they're not actually somehow in our hearts.
Yes.
And therefore, as I say, formative of our Christian discipleship.
Yes, I think the learning of texts by heart is still very important. And I think, the text that we as priests learn off by heart may be different from the text that we tell our people to learn off by heart.
We don't tend to tell anyone to learn anything off by heart these days.
No, but I think that may be a mistake. It's a kind of countercultural thing to say, learn it off by heart. You know, it's not seen as the way to do it. But I think if we completely get rid of it, we're throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So I think that there is a need for judicious learning off by heart of key texts. We'll never get to the stage of knowing, as priests may have done years ago, the Book of Common Prayer, you know, the Eucharist. That's never going to happen again, really. Or in the Psalter, you know. But we can pick out key texts and really strive to know them, because making eye contact with people is all part of that performance. You know, that's all part of not burying your head in a book. So I quite agree.
Any thought of making a common worship app?
Well, there are... see, the thing is, common worship is a library, right? It's not a book. Everything that's in common worship is online. It's just about knowing how to get to it. Mm-hmm. We are working at a sort of completely new visual liturgy thing, which is all going to be online. It's not going to be CD. It's going to be much easier to work. It's going to take a couple of years. Because you know, money, finance, staff, resources, all of that. But there are apps. There's going to be a lectionary app. There are things in the pipeline.
Yep.
And the offices are there. I mean,
yeah.
There's My CME, which...
Oh, I wasn't aware of that.
Yeah, it's called My CME. It's on App Store. And basically what you do is you go on to the day of the week on the calendar. You click it and you get morning prayer or evening prayer. It's all set up for you. And you know, it's free. So there are things that are there.
And I think they need to promote them a bit more.
Yes, well, I am aware of these issues. Unfortunately, 2 days a week for the Church of England.
Thank you for the information.
I'm sorry.
Well, I'm afraid we're going to have to draw this to a close, but again, do... feel free to pursue Christopher about these matters. Inducing him by a whiskey or a lozenge might help.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.